Hello, everyone, and welcome to Celebrating Cinema, a podcast for the love of cinema. I'm your host, Lara Romans, and today, documentary filmmaker Kiriko Mechanicus will be talking to film critic Hugo Emmerzahl about the necessity of documentary films for the times we live in, which coincides with the release of Ukrainian filmmaker Mirchislav Chernov's harrowing documentary, 2,000 Meters to Andriivka. If you want to support the work we do, then you can leave us a review and share this episode with friends, as it helps more cinema lovers find us. Before we dive in, here are some things going on at Lab 111 in Amsterdam that you should know about. On the 18th and 25th of January, our film and food series is back with a screening of Ramen Shop with, you guess it, a steaming bowl of ramen made by the Strangelove Kitchen. On the 28th, we have a Fight the Power screening of Goodbye Julia, followed by a panel talk discussing the ongoing genocide in Sudan. And you can also check out It's Never Over, a new documentary about the amazing Jeff Buckley.
Hugo.
Kiriko.
How have you been?
I'm doing great. I saw Avatar 3, Fire and Ash this week. And I think some reviews are already coming out, so I can say that as a big Avatar fan, I thought it was an absolute banner.
So wow.
I'm very hyped.
Yes, I'm excited for you mostly.
Thank you. I'm also excited for myself. I'm trying to do an insane scheme. I'm trying to land an interview with James Cameron.
Oh my God.
Which is not easy because, as you can imagine, he's quite busy and in demand. But this is now the big project for the holiday days.
That's your New Year's resolution?
Yes. It's scary but exciting.
Wow.
Yes. How about you? What's the vibe?
I've been good. I recently saw a lot of things, actually. I saw the new Pim Fortuyn documentary.
I still have to see it.
So it's a documentary series of 8 episodes. It's for Dutch TV, and it's about Pim Fortuyn, who, for those of you who are not from the Netherlands, a Dutch politician who basically started the movement of anti-Islam here in the Netherlands 25 years ago.
But he was at your service.
He was at our service, an incredibly charismatic and also quite
evil.
Charming
yes.
Man who really has the charm of the devil.
Yes.
And the documentary series is made out of only archival material from this time period. And it's, I think, the first time in my life that I watched footage from a time that I was alive.
Yeah.
In a chronological way where you sort of almost see yourself growing within this footage and you start recognizing more and more because it's like in this moment of time that I was like 5, 6, 7.
What a trip.
And it's quite special to go back to this time as an adult. It's I highly recommend it for those of you who speak Dutch, because I think
thank
it's
you
only
for reminding me, because it was on my list and then I kind of lost track of it, but this will be some mandatory holiday viewing well for me.
Yeah, it's very powerful. Speaking of mandatory stuff
and powerful films
and powerful stuff, today we're going to talk about documentaries.
What's that? I've never heard of it.
It's been a long time coming. We've done this podcast yes. for 5 years.
Maybe
and now is the moment that we're doing this
to talk about the creative treatment of reality.
Oh my God.
For a deep cut, one of our first episodes was about documentaries.
Was it?
What's her name? Is it Miriam Goodman?
Yeah, with Miriam Goodman.
Miriam Goodman. Yeah. That's true. The Seed of Deceit.
Yes.
That was also quite powerful. But yeah, we're coming back to it because I think in the recent times, I think documentary is changing a lot. The way we're watching them is also, yeah, quite different, at least for when I speak for myself. And I think the documentaries that are being made, they're multiplying in such incredible pace, and in that it's beautiful to see because they're going in so many different directions, but also a bit scary because it changes our perception of truth as well.
And you wrote a code open
that I did.
Maybe deals with these ideas.
Let me dive into
Let's dive into it, yeah.
Last week, I finished an intense week of back-to-back documentaries during the ITFA, which is the International Documentary Film Festival here in Amsterdam. Last Wednesday, I woke up at 8 a.m. to go to the cinema to see an almost 3-hour-long film about the effects of psychosis. The film making a convincing argument that those who experience psychosis might be experiencing reality in a realer way than we do. actually had very little time to reflect upon this because the screening was immediately followed by a short film with the harrowing accounts of a female refugee about the Uyghur prosecution, followed by then the newest Werner Herzog documentary about the disappearing species of large elephants in Angola due to large-scale animal hunting. And then I ended my day with a documentary about a father in the US who lost his son due to a fentanyl addiction. It was then 8 p.m. and I sat on the stairs outside of the cinema, munching away my dry falafel sandwich, figuring out how to process all the human atrocities that I had witnessed in the past 12 hours, and how I could relate to or do something about all that pain that wasn't mine. I felt hopeless, maybe more hopeless than how I felt before I had seen all of these films, and I lost sight of why we do this to ourselves. Why do we make documentaries? And why do we watch them? It's like drinking an extremely diluted version of the poison that intoxicates our world, spreading the evil thin enough that it doesn't actually kill you or inflict any form of change, but it does make me sick enough to feel that it is there and it lingers for a lifetime. If seeing those films does not change anything, except for making us lose our faith, maybe it felt as if I could have been better off without them. I was 22 years old when I decided that I wanted to make documentaries myself. It was the same year that Trump had just been elected as a president. But it was not just me who wanted to make documentaries. In that year, 1.6 billion people worldwide had a smartphone, and many people decided to make documentaries, even people who didn't have an interest in film. But many of them had a large interest in mostly themselves. Everybody's truth became directed and scripted, and changed, moved less and less outward, but became centered around ourselves, with the camera branching from a stretched arm, circling around our own heads, repeating our own words to ourselves. Life felt like theater. Since then, it is often that I ask myself these questions on why we make documentaries and why we watch them. Many are very hard to see and makes it hard to be optimistic. But I also know that it is even harder in an algorithm-driven world to see the things that you don't want to see. We live in a swamp of insane quantities of images and words and talk that we've heard before, because most of them are our own words and thoughts, as they are repeated to us in slightly different variations. It is these documentaries that live against the pressure of habit and the ease of our own thoughts and environment. They screen the darkness that we by default ignore, and have the rare bravery of pointing the camera outward. I easily forget what the diluted venom has done to me over the years. That simple attention is already a rarity, but also the seed of responsibility, and they change lusters in every single moment.
Beautiful. Very true words that inevitably arise when documentaries become the window to which we have to spectate what is happening in the world.
Yeah.
But I immediately want to counter it with saying, isn't it still better than just reading the news? Isn't reading the news to a certain degree much more soulless, much more harmful and painful when it's just facts and data and loose narrative framing of a journalistic story?
I would say logically, yes, because there's very few ways, or maybe even no ways, for us to feel what the news is, or to understand what a number...
What is the news? Yes, no, it's true.
Or what a number actually means. And I think with a documentary, of course, a good documentary makes you feel this horror, but then I think it's the feeling of staying with this horror within your own environment afterwards that confuses me so often. Or leaves me lingering in a darkness that isn't my own. And also, I don't really have a place to bring it or to take it to, which I think is a feeling that I have often. So I think it's not that, it also makes it so evident that a documentary is so powerful, but yet I find it more and more difficult to watch them.
Well, I think we can immediately connect this to the film which is also one of the reasons that we're doing this episode today, which is the release of the new documentary by Mieczyslav Czernow, 2000 Meters to Andriivka, a Ukrainian filmmaker capturing how Ukrainian soldiers are trying to regain the tiny village of Andriivka, which is captured by Russian soldiers. And the 2000 meters of the title is the distance that these Ukrainian soldiers have to cross to reach the village, and it's an extremely treacherous, dangerous, and scary endeavor.
Ukrainian forces have now launched their much-talked-about counter-offensive,
expected to be the biggest military operation in Europe since World War II.
Speaking about difficult films to watch, you watched it this morning.
I did.
How are you?
I'm okay. I'm okay, but I'm in a different... It stays now and forever, probably. But you chose to talk about this film today. I'm curious why that is, or what your relationship is to this documentary specifically.
Well, I saw it about a year ago on a screener while I was in Rotterdam for the film festival. And I saw it with my girlfriend on the laptop at night. And it made an insane impression immediately as well. This is an extremely harrowing and deeply immersive film in which you see this regaining of this village, this skirmish from the perspective of GoPro helmets of the soldiers, from drone cameras that are hovering the battlefield as a means of military surveillance, but also actually you see the cameras from kamikaze drones that are actually being used to bomb enemy soldiers. So there's a degree of actually watching death and, you know, military kills on screen, because you see the camera going landing literally in the soldier's proximity. And then there's the camera of the filmmaker and his co-director, like assistant director, Mieczyslav Czernow, who's following one battalion very closely on the foot as they make a dash towards this village. And the proximity to war is just insane, right? Because it's like, how, again, if we're comparing it to news, we have an idea in our head of what the war in Ukraine, the modern day trench warfare, looks like. And then you see a deeply immersive film, which is often being compared to video game level immersion, because you're so close in the POV of these soldiers as well. It's insane. This is what modern warfare in the outskirts of Europe looks like, apparently. So yeah, it's a film that stayed with me for a long time, and it expanded very greatly because I was also in Kyiv in Ukraine during its Ukrainian premiere. And I saw the filmmaker there, of course, but also all the surviving, because many of the soldiers that you see in the film that become actual characters die. But all the surviving soldiers that are in the film were also on stage. It was insane. 10-minute long standing ovation before somebody even spoke a word. All the soldier speech, everybody clapping again. Silence for minutes on end as well. It was one of the most insane and painful and beautiful film screenings I've ever seen in my life.
I can imagine. One thing that I realized while I was watching it is that all of the images that I know from war, or from this, the idea of being on a front line of war, I constantly compared the experience from what I knew, quote unquote, knew from what it meant to be on a front line, which is all experiences that I thought I knew, but were only based on fiction films.
Exactly.
And every moment that you're in these trenches with this military man, I thought, oh, this is actually quite different from what I thought that war was. Because already this frontline war that I knew from fiction had become reality in my own head. But then I saw these men with, like, really... You see them carrying, like, 20 kilos of stuff on their back constantly. You feel sort of, like, the heaviness of it. Like, you feel the sweat inside of their
uniform,
which is... the only thing that I can at that moment relate to, because it's the only thing that I think I could potentially live or have lived to carry a lot of stuff.
what you say raises a very interesting question, and not to immediately go too deep, but this is of course a thing that's been very often said about the depiction of maybe the biggest brutal event of modern history of humanity, the Holocaust.
Mm-hmm.
That most of our memories and our conception of what we know of the Holocaust is entirely filtered through fiction films, through Schindler's List, through all of these other famous and non-famous and beautiful and awful and spectacular and sad films like Son of Saul or whatever, you know, and recently The Zone of Interest. All of these films have made a collective image of what we all know is the Holocaust, right?
Mm.
And then you have a filmmaker, documentary filmmaker like Claude Lanzmann, who made, what is it, 5-hour, 7-hour opus Shoah in the 1980s, in which he tries to use documentary reality to show the Holocaust in this non-spectacle way, to kind of make it a testimonial, memory, narrative-driven experience. And why it's good that we're talking about Andriivka, and why we're talking about documentaries and what is good about them and necessary about them, but what is also strange, and what I want to kind of put against what you say, what can I even do with it after I saw it, is that a documentary in its definition is the creative treatment of reality, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this creative aspect is very often overlooked in conversations about films, because we're talking about how important it is that we see the front line of Ukraine, or how important it is that we will have films from Palestine documenting the horrific genocide, for instance, that is happening. All of these things are true. But it is also filmmakers making a narrative art, right? Mm. They're making a craft. It should be creative. Why Andriivka is so good is because on a film level, it's a masterpiece.
Mm-hmm.
It's so well made. The editing is so good.
Yeah.
The level of immersion is so impressive. The creative choices that he makes, even in these moments of extreme danger and terror, are beautiful. The film is spectacular and scary.
It's almost like an installation piece, because it's such a extremely physical experience.
So true. And so this is, I guess, basically the thing that I want to put against it. Isn't it also amazing that reality can be the raw material for art, and that documentaries can be about important things but can also exist on their own right as pieces of art, and that you can constantly go back and forth between these things? At least this would be my answer to your question, what to do with them. And this is how I personally also very often try to process them when I'm also kind of stuck on how horrific many of the stories are that you watch if you watch a lot of documentaries. And yeah, I think Andriivka is a very skillfully, artfully made film as a film.
I think that is also what makes documentaries oftentimes a lot more exciting than fiction, is because they have this in-between position of wanting to make a testament of this moment in time, but meanwhile also wanting to do that in one own way, in a personal way, and still also trying to understand what it is to be true to reality. It also makes it possible immediately, almost intuitively, I think, as a maker, to find ways to show this reality that are not narratively already known. I think, Itva is a place where it really sort of celebrates this idea of taking the medium of cinema and taking it to a level that it doesn't really know what level is coming next, but really trying to figure out where cinema can be. Yeah, where it can go. And I think fiction has, due to this fact, a lot to thank to documentary.
100%. Fiction in itself is very often steeped into a level of, let's say, narrative refinement. And we are so skilled at decoding fiction films because we've seen so much fictional elements of art and entertainment in our lives. It has the risk of becoming a priori too legible, right?
Yeah.
And there's great filmmakers that break with these conventions and do it at very ingenious ways. But it's true that documentaries a priori already can operate, because not all of them do, in this more artistic no man's land, where this gray zone between being very truthful, but also mediating this truthfulness through, let's say, the sensibility of the artist making it.
Yeah.
And to go back to Andriivka, you know, this director, Mieczysław Czarnow, who's a war reporter, first and foremost, he won an Oscar for 20 Days in Mariupol, which is a harrowing and incredible film. But this is mostly a triumph of reportage and journalism, because he was one of the only journalists in the city of Mariupol as it was being besieged and bombed.
Mm.
And he witnessed most of the mass killings that the rest of the world hadn't seen yet. And it put a face on what was the scale of the full-scale Russian invasion. And in interviews, this director now is saying that for him, Andriivka is his triumph of filmmaking.
Mm.
Because he doesn't want to be just a journalist. He's already done that a lot. He's been in a lot of war territories as a journalist and a reporter. He wants to make cinema. And his ambitions are in the realm of cinema. And this film reflects that. And I find this interesting, that a man who's been so diligent to capture reality as it is and to represent it fairly is now thinking about, but how can I grow as an artist?
Mm.
And I think this is a very fair question. And I'm wondering how you think about this, because you are a documentary filmmaker.
Well, I think, thankfully so, there's an idea of, I think, mainly journalists who are really stepping away from the idea that journalism is an objective truth, or at least here in the Netherlands, it's a discussion that has been going on for quite a while. And I think it really makes it also, I think that is so true in I think documentary is a testament for this truth. And I think it also has to do a lot with trust, in a way, that you immediately, as an audience, you need to trust a maker to believe that the truth will be given to you, which I think is a trust that is very uncommon, especially in journalism now. I think nobody believes what they read unless it's coming from people who are their own. And even more so for fiction film. Like, I think it's the first thing that you doubt of when something doesn't come off as true or realistic. You snap off. Like, it's,
yeah, or when you don't believe or trust in the vision and the skill of the director to deliver the story in a way that you see fit. Like, just a very off thing, but I remember seeing this Oz Perkins horror film, Long Legs, which has Nicolas Cage in it. And I see the first shot. And it's this shot of a house in the snow, and it has all this, like, tasteful, hip, A24-ish kind of graphic design in the opening and things. I see the first shot, and I'm like, I don't trust this guy immediately. I mean, this is going to be shit.
Yeah.
It's awful, but it's true. Because the rest of the film is complete dog shit, right?
Yeah.
So in fiction has, like, suffers from this very much, because, like I said, we're quite skilled viewers, even if you would consider yourself not a cinephile.
No, it's a very intuitive viewer.
Yeah. And with documentaries, it becomes even more interesting what that trust actually is.
I think it has, the trust becomes even more intuitive. And I think you immediately feel it when you see a film. I think most good documentaries give you the sense of observing with a lot of attention, or being in a place and knowing how you frame something in a way that you frame the world when you are close to something. To stay with something for longer than you would.
Yeah, because in this, like, attention span degraded world, the biggest thing you can give something is your attention, right?
Exactly.
This is our most valuable commodity.
Exactly, and that is, I mean, essentially what documentary is about, no? Like, looking around in the world and pausing and then zooming in and staying there and, going inside of it.
It's so nice in your cold open that you mentioned also that you saw a new Werner Herzog film, which I haven't seen yet, by the way, but I am hyped.
Mm-hmm.
Because the irony with Werner Herzog documentaries, for if you don't know him, the great German filmmaker, iconic, easily, like, imitated, almost memeable director who made fantastic films like
Who we made a great episode about also, yes, no? I think.
True.
Yeah.
Like made films like The Grizzly Man and stuff. The irony of Werner Herzog documentaries is that you trust to not get reality, but to be deceived a little bit, to get his wonky interpretation of reality, which is not truthful per se, but it has a ring of truthfulness to it. And it's this ring of truthfulness that makes them interesting, because he puts a spin on the things a little bit. But then you are placing this confidence in the hands of an author who will say, I will distort reality a little bit for you so that you can see it through my eyes and through my like crazy brain, and to be a little bit part of that, for like to snack a bit on Herzog's perception of the world, which is a crazy one, but it rings true, right? There's an emotional, sublime truth to it.
Absolutely. And I think that is also the reason why he has become the man that he is today in our cinephile world, but I think in general, for a lot of people, we trust him with our own heart. And I think because he has had the ability for so long to not show us how the elephants are doing in Angola, but to show us what hell on earth looks like, we immediately understand it. And through his perspective, I believe that there's hell on earth, but also heaven on earth. He's really capable of showing that to us. And I think now what I mostly felt when I saw this elephant film, it's called Ghost Elephant. There is also such a strong sense of comfort in watching his stuff, because you've seen it so many times already. And it is now, I wouldn't say formulaic, but to an extent, you do know what's coming when you're watching a Herzog film. And I think going to the cinema and, yeah, finding this balance between moving between hell and heaven in the way that he does, it's you take it with you in the way you see the world also after you walk out of the cinema. And he gives a lot of hope. I think we were talking about this in the episode that we were recording about him like last year, that it is in his fiction films that he shows the evil of mankind, and mostly in his documentaries that he finds compassion within this evil, which is, yeah, quite rare.
It's also for this very reason that I've become lately so obsessed with Adam Curtis, who has a sort of Herzogian trick, which is to pull all of these disparate sources of archives from history and connect them in a way that seems almost random, but the through line of how he perceives the world and its political developments, and how this feeds into our perception of reality and ourselves and the culture, which is kind of like the lightning rod between all of these, let's say, touching points through which we think of ourselves as citizens, political entities. He makes such strange connections here.
Absurd.
But they work. Because then you're thinking suddenly, oh yes, of course, this thing that happened 100 years ago in Saudi Arabia made it so that 9/11 happened, and that because of that happened that we have this rapper who is popular now, or that we are now in the world of AI, and that this global corporation who is doing surveillance then is now influencing how we are talking on the internet. And like he's mapping out things in the world that a lot of people don't dare to map out so concretely, because they risk sounding too blatant or generalizing. But then it's so specific, and it just opens up these can of worms, and you're like going down the rabbit hole. It has a nice conspiratorial nod to it.
Extremely. But it's like, I have a question about this. Would conspiracy theories have been so big as they are now if it wasn't for Adam Curtis?
Well, I think he just tapped into, actually, in one of his documentaries, he's talking about some of the sources of conspiracy theories, where they came from. For instance, the Illuminati kind of like narrative, right? That it was literally planted by people that were trying to make a satire of people's suspicions and superstitions and conspiratorial thinking, which arose from class anxiety of Americans that were kind of like embarking in conquering the American landscape. it came with a lot of anxiety, and this fuels a lot of conspiracies, right? So there was a group of people that was trying to satirize this by saying that there's this evil Illuminati clan from Europe that came with the colonial era to America, etc. It's a hoax, you know? Mm-hmm. And he retraces this back, how a hoax can become reality. Mm-hmm. And I think he took something from this playbook, which is that if you insert a certain fact from a certain point, you can map an emotional truth to where it leads us now. And this is a guiding strategy in his work, but this is how every conspiratorial strategy works.
Mm-mm-mm.
It's for this reason that there are critics that are specialized in documentaries that don't like his films, because they say, yes, it has a ring of truthfulness to it, but it is not robust journalistically enough to actually make these claims. But what he actually does is make an emotional history of a time in which we are insanely lost.
Yes.
In what even is going on all the time. It's fucking crazy, right?
Yeah.
And he's trying to map this out on an emotional level because he understands that we don't care for the headlines in the newspapers. We don't want to read the essay in some complicated journal. We need to be taken by the hand. Mm. And he does it very well. And why I think he's better than your average, for instance, 9/11 truther or other conspiratorial thinker, is that he actually does the work on a very deep level, right?
Yeah. The films that he makes, I haven't seen that many, but you feel that there is a historian who is speaking to you. So they don't feel at all like invitations to do the similar work and make connections that you sort of understand, but not really. Like, it's really pure guidance.
What is so nice about it is that you will see clips that in themselves are already an entire film.
Mm.
Like, for instance, in his latest series, Shifty.
I haven't seen that.
It's about how everything in the UK after Thatcher's era basically went to shit. And the title is Shifty because our perception of reality has become shifty in the late liberal capitalist era, right? It ends on such a funny note that it's the dawn of the new millennium. And the UK is building this massive stadium in which they should celebrate the New Year's Eve from 1999 to 2000. And it will be like a pavilion of the future of the UK. And they have all of these zones, these rooms that they have to decorate with various bits. Things about the history of labor, about spirituality, about the economy, about culture, the British culture, this and that. And then you see these working meetings of commissions being in rooms discussing what to put in these zones. And nobody knows what to put in the spirituality zone for a country that is deeply Islamophobic and doesn't tolerate basically anyone that is not white and Christian. Well, maybe no religions. Maybe it should just be empty phrases like believe, create, divine, or whatever. You know, just empty signifiers.
Yeah.
And then they try to build it, and then it's the New Year's, and you have Tony Blair and the Queen sitting in this temple being built for the future of a country, and it doesn't know what the future is because they are not very well, let's say, in touch with their own past. And this is some tiny snack, some example how you can illustrate the entire picture of the country through one place, one time. It's so gratifying, these kind of things. It's very good.
You recently said that you started shifting more towards documentary from fiction. And I wonder if that changes your perception on film or cinema as a whole.
Well, I think it comes, why this happened is because when I'm at this big film festival like Cannes or Venice, very often I'm kind of disappointed now by what I said earlier, the level of convention that is palpable in fiction films and how they almost wholesale try to refuse to actually wrestle with what I find the more important aspects of what it means to be alive right now. Sense of constant anxiety about what's happening in the world, how everything is mediated through our digital screens, how we are actually on the internet a much more real and locked in version of ourselves than when we're going through these banal things. And like a neo-realist art house film in which you see me sitting in the bus for 15 minutes is not a truthful representation of who I am anymore. And I find that documentaries have a relatively more untapped potential to try to convey all of these things. And I see that filmmakers that dare to work in a non-fictional format, even if they come from a fiction tradition themselves, are usually much more truthful to those things. So it is just a matter of potentiality. And like you said, this gray area of documentaries for me is now very exciting because there's so much happening. There's so much potential for documentary filmmakers to be more immediate, to respond to the world, to convey things also in a creative way, on an emotional way that seems right. So I think this is it. And I think you also do that with your recent projects, right? What you showed me, this installation work that you did, where you also use GoPros. Maybe you can briefly talk about it. Because this is actually, for me, this is how we should be thinking about how to mediatize what happens in our lives and in the world.
Yeah. Yeah, so I recently did a project. It's called the Intergenerational Cooking Show, where I do it together with a friend of mine, an artist called Noah Jansma, where we invite teenagers to interview their grandparents and to cook with them and to create a dish which was relevant to the grandparent when they were the same age as their grandchild. And they both have a GoPro camera on their head, and they do this in their own home. And there's no camera crew who's present at this moment, which makes everything about it extremely intimate, because you're, of course, we all know what a POV perspective is, but you're in it during a moment that you've never seen in POV, because I think POV GoPro cameras are oftentimes used for like masculine sports like skiing
and internet pornography,
War zones.
Yeah.
It's not something that we relate to, this meticulous carrot cutting that is, you know, a large chunk of what this footage is when it gets sent back to us. But it's also this subtle movements of when you see two people looking each other in the eye, but also mostly when they're not looking each other. Yeah, it has this same physical sweating within someone else's body feeling is that I had this morning watching Andriivka.
Andriivka in the kitchen.
Andriivka in the kitchen, but in some ways a little bit more relatable.
Yeah.
And also just, yeah, this banality of life, and also how uncomfortable that is and how unstructured that is. And
but there's one, like, for instance, there was one bit where, so one of the couple take place in Japan, yeah, and then there's this guy who needs to run to the other bit of the house to get some, to fetch some eggs for a recipe. And then the grandma, I think, is
grandfather
is still in the kitchen, and the lad, he's running to the other house to get these eggs. And it's so kinetic and cool to see him run, and it's just this tiny thing, but I'm already on the fact and how it moves and what the camera does in our perception of reality. I thought it was so gratifying. It's so cool.
Yeah, it feels, you feel every single move, and it tells everything about the time that we live in, about how we treat other people. And it's, yeah, it's very documentary, because it's unfiltered reality, but through the frame of a concept, and life happens, and it really gives you flowers.
It reminds me of this documentary, which, if I'm not mistaken, is on Netflix, and I'm pretty certain it will win the Oscar for Best Documentary. Mm. It's a Perfect Neighbor.
911 status of the emergency.
Are you having problems with the neighbor's children?
Hello, sheriff's office. Were any of you guys over here messing with this lady?
No.
We were playing football.
It's this small, like, suburban community in America.
Mm-hmm.
Some tiny, outside of a city, in some seemingly insignificant place. And it's a place where a lot of kids play on the streets. And a lot of them are black boys. And there's this lady who lives in one of the houses who is insanely paranoid and has this kind of, like, schizophrenic, paranoid kind of leaning towards them, that she constantly thinks that while they're playing outside with the ball, that they're vandalizing their house, that they're trying to steal her stuff. And the film is mostly shot through the body cams of police people that she constantly calls because she's like, oh, these kids, they're trying to destroy my car and calling me a bitch and this and that. So you see a lot of these like body cam footage of these cops going, they go to these kids and like, hey, are you bothering this lady? And then they're like, oh, it's the Karen that called again. Yeah, she's always being crazy. And then they go to the mom of these kids and these moms are like, this lady is insane. She's always calling on these kids. They're just playing with the ball. And then tragedy happens. Some very scary stuff happens. But it's, again, you know, this like embedded camera is such a relatively novel thing that, and it's scary that, you know, police walk around with it. We all have a camera on our phone. People are constantly, you know, using GoPros in very clandestine, sometimes scary, sometimes secret, sometimes very positive ways. But it generates so much insane raw data that can lead to fascinating films.
Yeah.
This film is a great accessible mainstream example of how you can basically make a thriller, like a very scary horror film almost, about just a simple neighborhood where one scary lady lives on the block. And this is better than most horror films I've seen in the last years. It's a scarier film than all of the horror films I've seen in the last years.
Sounds incredible.
And this is cool for me that it's like, hey, of these genres that we think are exclusively fictional, actually also maybe work better in documentary.
Maybe it's just better in every possible way.
Maybe.
No, I don't know if that's true. I mean, it's, I think what is rare about documentary, and it's, that's why I watch fiction, is it's not easy for me to drift off in a documentary film in a way where I feel like I'm going to a place that I want to go to.
Yeah.
Documentaries are most of the time really sad and intense and make me angry and leave me filled up with the anger that I know but don't want to feel, which I think is, quite a bummer. I think a lot of documentaries also have the potential to be hopeful films. It just doesn't happen very often in the films that I see. However, I do want to specifically talk about a film that I also saw during the ITFA last week, which is the documentary that really changed my life. And it kind of draws me back to this thing that I was talking about in my cold open, that a lot of documentaries have the intention to change life, but then you never make it substantial in a way, or at least for me as a viewer, it never feels substantial. However, it's nice that I felt this again. It's from a 1991 film called Lessons from a Calf, which is the first film that Hirokazu Koreeda made, who is a fiction filmmaker who's known for
Shoplifters,
recently Monster, and I think his first big film was Nobody Knows.
Mm-hmm.
And he always makes like very intimate, sweet family drama about lower class Japan mostly. And this film is, I think, a television reportage. So it has a lot of artistic expression in it, but very moderate, about a class of school kids around 10 years old. And they're in this specific special educational program where they have to raise a calf. And that is their educational program. So they take care of this cow and they have to figure out how much money they need to have per year to figure out how much they can feed it and, you know, how it's... Yeah, the calf is the educational program. And it's the only instance that I've seen where you feel that kids are being taken seriously, not only in film, but I think in life. And it really made me understand a lot about how from a very early age, we don't really learn how to take care of one another and how to listen to one another. And I think it could have only been a documentary to tell this story, because you give the opportunity to a viewer to listen to someone who never gets listened to in a very, yeah, in a very kind way. It told me everything about what documentary can do for people. Yeah, not to become too woo-ish, but
no,
to
it sounds this, insanely this, tender and beautiful.
Yeah, to this, yeah, I think tender is the word for it. To learn how to be tender in the way that we look at life. It's on YouTube. I highly recommend everyone to see it.
I will immediately do it. I think we can make a great summation out of this conversation thanks to lessons from McAlf as well, which is that ultimately, I think the thing that documentaries in this time and age can give us is exactly like we said, to bestow attention and grace and to put things that seem almost too ordinary or too realistic on such a pedestal that we can perceive it as something unique, a phenomenon that deserves to be studied. Whether it's a war that's been going on for 4 years or it's something banal as cooking, but what it actually leads to, the interactions between generations, or how kids perceive of themselves and learn to grow up in this world. What fiction, however, can do is invite us ideally into worlds, ideas, stories that we don't know, that are unfamiliar in a different sense, that can, in that sense, trigger a curiosity of the unknown. And I think the best documentary filmmakers know how to draw from that, and the best fiction filmmakers, maybe it's all a big compromise, know how to tap into these vast, jarring, insane resources of reality to fuel their, like, to literally use it as the fuel for the engine of their narrative, right? And it's whenever I see this synthesis, and then it doesn't matter if I'm watching a supposed fiction or a documentary, then it becomes exciting, at least for me. And that's always what I'm looking for, I guess, more and more so, because I want films that seem honest and truthful and respectful to what the world is going through right now. Maybe it's about respect.
Maybe we should do a massive industry swap where all the fiction makers make documentaries and the other way around. I think it could lead to something beautiful.
I think it would be great, because then I think also a lot of filmmakers would give up. And this is also a good thing, I think. It will make our lives easier.
Yes. Let's start here.
And then they can get a real job, like work in an AI data center.
Delicious.
Well, Kiriko, thank you so much for these reflections.
Thank you. Thank you.
Don't forget to get your tickets to 2000 Meters to Andrivka and also the Oscar-winning 20 Days in Mariupol, also from Chernov. The link for the tickets is in the show notes. If you like this episode and what we do, please support us by leaving a review and sharing this episode with friends.
Stay connected with us at Celebrating Cinema and Lab by following at Lab111 on Instagram and Letterboxd. This was a Lab111 production, edited and produced by Elliot Bloom, with music from Hugo Emmertzahl and artwork from Studio FFF.